Welcome to If I Knew Then, What I Know Now. This podcast is brought to you by the co-founders of The Mindset Difference. That's myself, Roger Martin, and my business partner, Paul O'Connell. We, and our guests, are leaders who face difficult and sometimes harrowing challenges, primarily in the built environment, technology, and renewable energy sectors. Our intention in sharing how we tackle them and the lessons learned subsequently is to help you learn from our experience. We hope our insights prompt you to wonder if the mindset you show up from in similar situations makes a difference by helping you and colleagues be at your very best. Enjoy finding out. In this episode, I, Roger, am the guest on another podcast called Coaching Conversations, hosted by Carey Davis Munro and Julian Roberts. The aim of their podcast is to explore how people like myself got into leadership development and coaching. I open up a bit, exploring how difficulties at home led to some important insights about myself and the work I was doing. I hope you find it helpful.
Welcome to Coaching Conversations with Carey and Julian, where we delve into the story behind the coach. Welcome to Coaching Conversations with myself, Carey Davis Munro, and my co-host here, Julian Roberts. We, again, have another coach to speak to today, and we are delighted today to welcome Roger Martin. Roger is the co-founder and coach of a business called The Mindset Business. Roger, we're really pleased to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, nice to meet you virtually, Roger. Appreciate you being on this show. Just be good for us to know, well, two things really, a little bit about your how you became into get involved in coaching, but also that could lead on to your own business that you've co-founded as well. So, you know, start where you feel comfortable, really.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to start in about the late 1980s, if I might. I actually started out life as an accountant. So I was a Chartered Institute of Management accountant, working in a firm that was run by your archetypal command and control leader, mm-hmm. who behaved somewhat tyrannically, one might say, sometimes. And I thought this was no way to run a business. And I remember getting involved in, I remember talking to somebody in what was then known as personnel, which is nowadays known as HR, about a department in the finance function where I work, where they kept losing staff, you know, high levels of turnover. And it was a data entry job. These people came and they got bored and they left. And I said, oh, I could run a course on that. I could teach these people what the knock-on impact is if they don't do their jobs well, how the whole business could collapse. We didn't have the right data that they were pumping in into the system. So I did that and loved it. Absolutely loved the idea of helping people get a sense of fulfillment from their job rather than just see it as a...
Was this like a one-on-one or was this like a group thing you did?
No, I ran it for a group. I designed it for a group of about 10 at a time. And I say it because I found my vocation. I thought, I don't want to be dealing with the balance sheet and the sales forecast and the management accounts every month. You know, and I would get managers ringing me up saying, can you defer some income to next month? Or can you delay some costs to next month so that my numbers look great and the boss sort of builds me up on a pedestal rather than what he does for those whose numbers that were behind where they should be and beat them up, you know, or not physically, but verbally beat them up. So they were kind of like scared and wanting me to help out. Mm. And I just thought this is no way to do it. So anyway, I ran this course and that set my career really. From then on in, I've been in the field of leadership development, leadership coaching, executive coaching. And I enjoy the world of teams particularly. I do some one-to-one, but mainly it's team or group-based work.
So did that sort of that point when you found you got more fulfillment in helping others as opposed to just moving numbers on a spreadsheet, not that I'm diminishing a role of an accountant, but did you do something about that? Did that sort of change your course of career, training, everything else?
I did. I was very lucky because the parent company of the firm I was working for then almost created a job for me in their management training college near Abingdon. And I had a job where I was the accountant for the college part-time. And then I was running management training courses the rest of the time. So some of the time I was, you know, doing finance for the non-financial manager type training. But my heart was in the whole leadership field. You know, what does it take to be an effective leader of a team? And so, you know, ever since then till now, I've gone through various phases and fads, is that you might say, that have come through businesses, you know, from total quality management to lean to neuro-linguistic programming to all different types of ideas that business process re-engineering, benefits management, many different types of things. And what I've seen throughout that time, I guess what I've been a student of throughout that time, is what works and what doesn't. You know, what is it that makes some of those good ideas land well and in other cases not really land very well at all? And that's what I've been a student of. And I guess, if I'm honest with you, I had some conflict running in my head as I was taking that path, because in my personal life was kind of like disintegrating whilst at the same time I was trying to coach other people in how to be effective leaders. So I had a first marriage breakdown. I was estranged from my children for 24 years, but we've kind of reunited since. A second marriage that became very difficult. And I then studied counselling. I studied all the major psychological theories and a set of counselling skills as a way to not only understand my own struggles with depression and various other ailments that came from a difficult home life, but also to understand others and organisational behaviour much more clearly as well. So that was quite interesting, and I gravitated towards a learning pedagogy known as action learning, if you're familiar with that, where people bring along to a group live issues that they want support from the group, and a coach like me is there as well to make sure the group are focusing on the needs of each individual. And we used to have a process, you know, whereby the individual would spend, I don't know, 10 minutes tumbling out an issue that they wanted to do some work on. The group would then ask some questions of clarification. And then the problem owner, as it were, would turn around and they'd just have to eavesdrop on a conversation that the group would have. And the group would talk about the assumptions they hear being made and so on and so forth. And in the end, the group, the problem owner would turn around and say what they picked out from what they eavesdropped on as being useful. Well, what I noticed was in that first 10 minutes of that process, when a problem owner was tumbling out their story, there came a, I don't know quite how to describe it, but there was, at the moment when we put stuff out there, rather than just have it whirl around our head, you get this sort of release. There's a sort of relief on people's face. Mm. And I had an insight moment with one lady in the group when that happened. And my insight was this, that the personal life I was struggling with, rather than that be a barrier to doing the work I was doing, it was actually legitimized it. It made me more empathetic. It made me more real, I guess, more authentic. And so this dilemma I was having around, oh, how can I be a coach when my own life is screwed up, suddenly disintegrated. It sort of began to evaporate, really. And I started to feel more comfortable in my own skin. I've taken the pressure off myself to be this perfect individual that I, you know, could never be. So I found that really liberating.
Because I think as coaches anyway, you know, one of the things we say, isn't it? We don't have all the answers. We don't set ourselves up as knowing more than you. We don't necessarily have any experience in the area that you might bring us even, you know. So, you know, what you're saying is exactly true there. You didn't need, you know, the fact that you're going through issues yourself doesn't mean that you're not in a position to facilitate that for others. I wanted to ask you, Roger, because sort of going back, you know, you were in that company that there was a very difficult culture, and quite quickly you sort of facilitated a different role for yourself. Did you then go and do your basic sort of coach qualifications, and then you were bringing in and experiencing all of these other types of ongoing learning, really, your NLP that you mentioned and other things? And also, if I can latch onto the back of that, I sort of had this question. You know, with all the stuff, and thank you for your openness and honesty, with all the things that you were going through personally, what made you gravitate towards working with businesses rather than working with individuals?
I guess I've always been interested. You used the word culture there. I was working in a toxic culture, and I saw how that affected many people. Mm. You know, there was a great camaraderie amongst many of the colleagues I worked with, but it was in spite of the management, not because of the management. It was kind of us against the bosses. It wasn't quite that bad, but you know what I mean. And I don't know. I've always seen the collective more easily than I've seen the individual. And my route into coaching was really through the counseling field, you know. So I learned counseling skills, and I learned the major theories of counseling, you know, Freud and Jung and Carl Rogers and Adler and all of those guys. And then I melded that into my own coaching practice. And through the through the experience I had with action learning and that insight of, you know, how clarifying it can be for people to just air and talk about the stuff that they spend a lot of time thinking about, I started to look deeper into that. I started to look into the kind of world of philosophy and the world of neuroscience to try and understand this. Why do I experience life the way I do? Why do I have good days and bad days? Why is it one event on one day can make me outraged, and on another day I'll feel completely empathetic for the person who's trying to mess me up on the road, or, you know, cause me some aggravation? So I started to get interested in that. And I met my business partner, Paul, we form the mindset difference to try and bring a new understanding to teams around what is it that causes this fluctuation in our individual mood, and therefore the mood of the group, and how do we notice that? And of course, that takes us into the area of unconscious bias, and it takes us into the area of the relationship we have with our own thoughts. And so that's the work we do now. You know, we build it around, you know, often our clients are struggling with collaboration, that, you know, they to try to move forward on stuff. They need people to collaborate more, but often, certainly in the construction and engineering sector where we work a lot, the whole thing's geared to be very competitive and combative rather than collaborative. You know, it's a business where a lot of risk could materialize and people could be left holding the baby, and everything's geared to make sure you're not the one taking all the risk. So it mitigates against collaborative behavior because people are often operating from a survival mode. And that's what we try to interrupt, really. That's what we see the mindset difference as being, interrupting those patterns, those stories people carry in their head and have lived with as true for many years. But when they surface them and examine them a bit, show them the cold light of day, see that they needn't be their automatic response every time. You know, they could interrupt that and therefore create authentic different behavior. And that's what we do now. And I love it. I just love it. Because the reason I love it is it doesn't just solve real business problems. It also changes how people relate to their partners or their kids or their, you know, the rest of their family. So it spills into the whole of their life rather than just their work part of the life, which of course is consistent with the insight I had myself to 20 years ago.
Because coaching is a holistic thing. You're not just dealing with an individual in the workplace. When you do deal with them in the workplace, it actually does go to their personal life. And interesting you talking about when people reflect and talk out. So I found often a lot of clients I deal with who don't have time to think, the sort of senior executives, and actually having time to actually speak out their thoughts. There's incredible power in that and enabling them to reflect. And I remember an exercise I did in my coaching training where we spoke on a dilemma for 5 minutes and the other person couldn't say a word, just have to nod and listen. And actually by speaking the dilemma out, you start to come up with the solution, the ideas to deal with it. So there's massive power in speaking out. That's really interesting. So how do you then take this? You've mentioned the word collaboration quite a number of times, and you even mentioned it right at the start before we started the conversation. So it's obviously your thing. How does that in terms of form look like in a session or interaction with businesses you work with?
Well, we normally start with what's the business challenge that needs resolving. So that can be turning around the performance of a supplier who's not delivering what they should be, or it could be got an aggressive client who's on our backs all of the time, or it could be any number of presenting issues. So that's the starting point. And the assumption that we work from is that collaboration is an innate human trait. We're designed to collaborate, but the thinking loops we get into prevent it. So the approach we take, which is we sometimes describe as subtractive, not additive. So we're not adding knowledge and skills to people. We're helping them see what habitual thinking habits they get into that are often unhelpful. So, for example, having no time to think can mean you can show up to an underperformance problem with all the solutions in your head and telling somebody what to do, with little inquiry into what might be going on in their mind. You know, what are the stories they're living from? Mm-hmm. And once you understand that, the way forward might seem very different to the one you have in your head before you get to that point. So it's a part of the way we define collaboration is that it leads you to solutions that neither party can envisage before the collaboration begins. Mm. You know, it leads you to somewhere else, but it only leads you to somewhere else if you're open and can hear somebody, can listen to somebody, and are open to new ideas to explore ways forward that work for both of you. So the work we do is subtractive. We get people to notice the relationship they have with their thoughts, see those cropping up in real time.
Are you using NLP in that context?
No, we're using an understanding called the Three Principles, which is a philosophical understanding that looks at how our thinking patterns create our emotions, which then create our behavior. Yeah. And we look at the linkage between that in some depth so that people start to realize that they're caught in various thinking habits that always makes them feel anxious, for example, or angry, or
sort of playing a narrative in their head, basically.
Yeah, it's the story they're living from. So many, for example, many constructors I've noticed, this is a generalization, it won't be true for everybody, but many constructors live in a story of where the poor relations, right? So the client's got all the money. The subcontractor chain is trying to screw us for as much money as possible, and we're the poor relations in the middle. Now, if you live from that story, and that's the way it's always been, you know, the notion of partnering with a client, of seeing the joint interest you've got in doing the project well, gets obliterated and obscured because you're forever being the subservient one in the relationship rather than the equal partner.
So can I just ask, are these sessions then constructed as sort of part training? I'm just trying to get to the bottom of the format. I'm presuming they're quite small group sessions. What's the largest you'd have in there? And is it sort of a divide between some training and the constructs and the concepts that you're informing us of now and then input? Or how's it structured? How do you work those coaching groups?
On the size issue, it's usually about 10 to 14 max, you know, which could be one team, one intact team, or it could be people drawn from different parts of the organization.
Yeah.
The training element, there is a very small component, which is we teach what we call the human operating system, how this linkage between the patterns of thinking we live from, the emotions they generate, and the behavior they generate. So we put a small amount in around that, because, you know, what we're trying to point to is that invisible stuff that goes on in our head that no one can see, right? So we use a lot of metaphor for that. But the majority of the work is in helping people notice how that thought, feeling, behavioral link shows up from moment to moment. So we're holding a lot of conversations and reflections that are helping people see that when they went down route A or route B, it was because they were feeling this and that was because they were thinking that.
So how do you get them to realize that?
Well, that's the trick of our trade, I guess. It's what we have learned since doing this is you need to create an atmosphere where people's minds slow down. So the quieter their mind becomes, the more easier it is to see how this thought, feeling, behavior linkage works in double quick time. if your mind's busy, if you're in a lot of thought processing going on, it's very difficult to have insight, to see afresh, to have new thinking, because your neuroplasticity, as it were, is still going around the same loops it's always gone around.
And how do you do that in terms of the specifics in a session? What would you do?
Well, we normalize a learning experience that isn't usual, right? So we'll say, you know, we're going to work in a very slow fashion. It's going to be a very reflective fashion. We're not going to have sessions longer than 2 hours. We're going to have long lunch breaks. We're going to encourage you to put your mobiles in this box, and we're going to lock the box, and you can have them back at the end of the day. So we create what we call a retreat-like atmosphere.
Okay.
And it's not a retreat, so don't get me wrong. It's not there's no bells and meditating going on.
Joysticks and nothing else. No.
there's certainly no electrodes involved either, which some people get anxious about sometimes when you talk about mindset. But it's in what we find is that when people's minds slow down and they're able to see the thought patterns that they live their life from much more clearly when they're in a relaxed state.
Mm.
And it's there that you get the insights, what we call the fresh perspective, new thinking begins to arise at that point. And that's when whatever the business challenge is, you know, so whether it's shifting the culture in the team, or whether it's trying to grow revenues, or whether it's turning around underperformance, whatever the issue is that the program is designed around, those moments of insight are where team members start to see that problem from an angle they've not seen before. And that's when solutions begin to evolve that were simply not possible for the team while they were in their situation normal beforehand. Mm-hmm. So that's how we work it. We don't teach A, B, and C and then say, go off and do it. We start from the place of, This is how the mind functions. Now see it in your own life, and let's explore it in your own life in a very relaxed, calming atmosphere. And then once they've seen it in their own life, we turn to the business problem. And then people start to look at that business problem from a very new and different perspective to the one they were in before, which then makes possible new ways forward that simply weren't available before.
Okay.
And does that entail going through, different exercises with them? So you take the phones away, you put them in this environment, which is more calming, I guess the pulse slows down and everything else. And then is it, you take them through a number of exercises
We do some exercises. For example, listening is a pretty key component to any relationship, and it's a pretty key component to any problem-solving activity in order for you to understand that the nature of a problem, you need to listen to other people's perspective of it, so you see the different, the multiple realities, the different realities in play. So to help people see what listening is about, we don't go down a classical active listening route, which would be, to teach, to have some questions in your back pocket or to summarize what somebody's saying at certain points and move forward. We create an exercise where people can see that they're very, very acute listeners when they have no thinking on their mind. So the less thinking you're doing,
you like get them into the now state. Then is that what you're doing?
Into now, yeah. You bring them into the present, where there's nothing else. The mind's not busy.
No.
Their capacity to listen rockets. And it's quite an eye opener for some people. It was for me. I always thought I was a great listener. And I thought, you know, and when I discovered this, I thought I wasn't a good listener at all. I used to take loads and loads of notes, which was sort of proof that I was a good listener. So I, whereas now I never take a notebook into a meeting. I may have something, I've got to jot numbers down. I might just jot, you know, facts down. But if I can avoid it, I will. And I just stay present to what's being said. And I find my recall afterwards, not only of what was said, but the intonation in what was said, it's astounded me, actually. It's astounded me. And I also note that when I'm asked in a meeting for a comment, because I've listened well, my comment is heard more. You know, it carries more gravitas because you can respond in the language of the person themselves has been using because you've attended to that, you've heard that. So it's back to this starting point, really, is that we humans are very good at listening. We're very good at being curious. We're very good at collaborating, save for when we're caught up in thinking habits that get in the way of that. So the issue is noticing the habits that get in the way, not attending to them, and therefore being present. That's what gets us into a place where we can get more done. So that's what I mean by the kind of subtractive. Subtract the stuff that gets in the way, get back to what's innate, and then stuff starts to happen much more easily.
I think that's mindful interaction, really, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is mindful. It's very akin to mindfulness. So there's a very strong, you know, I think it was the Buddha that said all human suffering comes from not seeing the world clearly. And in that sense, we are encouraging people to be mindful of their mindsets, their thinking habits, their biases in any moment, and to not take them seriously. To see this distinction between there's you and the thoughts coming through your mind. You know, you are not your thoughts. No. And that distinction seems to be really key for people because they can then be observers of the thoughts that pop up in consciousness rather than be the subject of them. So it gives them a bit of distance, as it were, to say, well, should I take that thought seriously? I know I've done in the past a lot, but do I need to hear? Well, maybe not. And that's what I've learned seems most helpful to people and myself. You know, I've seen that in myself. So
I think you're right. And you know what I'm thinking as you're saying that we're living in quite stressful, difficult times right now where people are spending a lot of time by themselves. And I think that one of the reasons that we're seeing mental health rocket and people in such difficult states in terms of their mental health is partly because you're left alone with your own thoughts. You know, you're left alone with that own monkey mind. There's not the same interaction. There's not the same level of support. You're not having that same level of interruption, as it were, and interaction to stop those stories. And I think that's when it's becoming, you know, I think that's a huge reason that this is rife and a huge worry for people at the moment, you know.
No, I agree, Kerry. And I think that, you know, it's not, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying I've got a panacea all answer thing here. I get down too, right? Mm. We all get lost in our thinking.
Yeah. Right?
That's just part of the human condition. But if you understand that thought is temporary in its nature, it's transient. And if you understand you're not your thoughts, you don't need to be the sum of your thoughts, but you can be the observer of them. That distinction means that when you get down, you needn't be down for long. It also means you don't need to necessarily manage the conditions you're in when you're down. So it's not about having to work your way out of it. You know, confident in the knowledge it will pass, it does. But when we ruminate, you know, when I used to suffer depression a lot for months on end, because I would get onto a train of thought that I couldn't get out of.
Mm.
And I think it was me. You know, I think that these are the cards life has dealt me. Poor old me, I have to live with it. But as soon as I started to see, well, these thoughts are just coming through me, and the meaning I make of them, the attention I pay them, is up to me. And sometimes, you know, that's unhelpful. And if I can see that in the moment when it's happening, I know I don't need to go there in the way I once automatically went there. In other words, a choice appears for me, which never appeared before because I didn't see it.
Mm.
And that's, so it's a distinction between understanding one's experience as it unfolds and having a sense of that versus trying to make it better should that experience be not good, like working on yourself.
So Roger, can I ask, because it's very interesting for me, did you manage to get yourself out of those depressions? And have you, you know, you're absolutely right. We all have down days, whoever we are. Life is, you know, can be challenging at the best of times. So do you now have a certain practice that you go through, or when this comes along, how would you, because I think this is really important. If we can, we like to sort of help people along the way.
Yeah.
How do you come out of that? And how do you go through that process? Because I know that when you're entrenched in those, you know, I know people very closely with deep depression. When you're in those deep, dark days and you have got all that catastrophic thinking and, you know, everything is black and white and all your language is wrong. And how do you break that? Because often you're so used to it, you almost are so entrenched. And I don't mean this in the wrong way, but some people almost want to keep going round and round, don't they? How do you break it?
Well, I was like that. You know, it wasn't black and white. It was like black.
Yes.
You don't want to get out of bed. And even the loved ones around you that want to help show up as a nuisance. You know, even though they're being good intentions and wanting, looking after your welfare, it's a horrible thing to say, but those people who have suffered depression will know that that appears as unwelcome, you know,
yes.
Even though people have your best interests at heart. So that's how horrible it is. It's really horrible. Now, years ago, I medicated out of it. So usually with alcohol, which wasn't a good idea, but then later through antidepressants. But now, I'm talking 15 years ago, which is quite some time ago. But since I've moved into this sort of world of philosophy and neuroscience, trying to understand how experience forms, I now don't take any medication whatsoever. I still drink, but not a lot. And I just have awareness that, you know, there'll be days when things will go down, and days when they'll go up. But understanding that this is transient thought coming through me, and if I ruminate on stuff, my lower mood will be longer than it would be if I didn't, seems to be enough to make the down periods shorter and not too much to the same depth. And the higher days are a more frequent and that lasts longer. So, you know, if you were talking to somebody that knew me 15 or 20 years ago, they probably wouldn't recognize the same Roger today, because I, you know, my overall frequency is up several notches from where it used to be, because the downs are not as prolonged or as low, and the higher highs, you know, I just operate at a higher level, I think. So now you
are practicing what you're preaching, which is aligning to what you're teaching or your coaching within your clients, you're doing it yourself. Doesn't mean, as you say, you're perfect. Doesn't mean your days are always high, but at least you're putting those practices in place, and you've obviously got the self-awareness and the education. In terms of your clients, just a curiosity of how did you get into the whole just construction piece? Just very briefly on that. And what is it? Because you were in that background, or it just, yeah.
I've done a lot of work in the NHS originally, but I got invited to do some work with a team on a big infrastructure project, and the team was in was struggling with tight deadlines and being under-resourced and so on and so forth. And the behavioural response to those pressures was what you expect to see in teams under pressure. So, you know, communication wasn't great and people not responding to emails and so on and so forth. And through that experience, we helped with that team enormously. And through that experience, what I felt was there was a lot of men in this industry. The industry needs more women desperately, but it's predominantly men, roughly of my age group, living in a macho culture where the bravado, which is bravado of being tough, what is really important to survive. You know, that's the world they live in. But when you get to talk to these guys really, you know, honestly, without the bravado around, it's a difficult world to be in, and they don't like it, and they'd prefer it if it was different to that. They prefer it if it was more cooperative, more collaborative, and we could get so much more done so much more quickly. You know, it's an industry that's renowned for projects coming in late, projects being overspent. Mm. And at the heart of that, you know, the academic research shows that it's people's inability to collaborate, their tendency to be over-optimistic in terms of how long it takes to do things, the tendency to, you know, be economical with the truth when it comes to how much things cost, etc. So this is the world they live in, and I felt I can help here.
Because it's all self-perpetuating, isn't it, Roger?
Yeah.
When I'm listening to you, it's all, well, you know, they're carrying on practices that aren't beneficial, but self-perpetuating if everybody's involved in this.
You know, there's that old adage, isn't it? The fish doesn't know it's wet. You know, like when you're caught up in a culture, that's just the way it is. That's just how, you know, the way it is all, is the only way there is. That's how it seems to people. Yeah. And it's not until these thought patterns get interrupted and people, you know, people start to do some little experimenting with different approaches here and there, like, you know, like listening better or like, you know, trying to really get where somebody else is coming from before you jump to a solution. These tiny things, they start to make a difference. It requires people to realize for themselves the story that they're living from. It's not for me as a coach to say, you're living in a poor relation story, or you're living in a victim story, or you're living in this story. I don't believe that's my, it's too presumptuous, and it's not my prerogative to do that. So the way we do things, we structure things so that people can see that in themselves. So when they realize that for themselves, that's the limitation that they're living by, and they subject that to a bit of scrutiny, that old mindset then doesn't seem to make sense anymore. You know, it makes no sense now to always show up believing I have to be the winner, or always show up from an aggressive standpoint. It makes no sense anymore. So then what happens is that, you know, project directors, etc., start to make small experiments that they conduct themselves and create themselves about how they might, what they might do if they show up from a different perspective, from a win-win perspective, mm-hmm. rather than a win-lose perspective, or they, you know, that they see the client as a partner rather than the master to whom they're the servant. So once that shifts, they start to make these small experiments themselves, and we've had some great results. You know, we've had clients talking about how they've, you know, shifted their own personal reputation and the reputation of their business with key clients mm-hmm. because they're simply showing up to them in a different way to the way they
rewriting those stories, isn't it? And tweaking how you show up, showing up in a different way.
I can't quite describe it, Kerry, to go. I felt sort of called to the construction sector. You know, it felt like an obvious thing to do. I mean, I had colleagues say, "Oh, why would you go and work in that sector? You know, it's litigious. You know, they'll be seeing you left, right, and centre, and you know, it'll be very difficult." And
you've obviously found your niche, and you've obviously found that a place where collaboration clearly is not working, and what you've talked about, and obviously that's where you seem to bring this piece of collaboration, which creates the opportunities, opening people's eyes, different mindsets, different approaches, which is where there's some value. I'm drawing us to a close right now, just to so as we always ask our guests, it's almost, you know, how can people get in touch with you if they want to sort of use your services in this context?
Well, that's great. So the website is themindsetdifference.com. And you can get in touch with me at Roger, with no D, R-O-G-E-R, at themindsetdifference.com.
Brilliant. Roger, it's really been a fascinating conversation. I love the fact that Julian and I learn so much, and we're continuing our own CPD through the conversations that we have with others. It's been really insightful and, a real delight to speak to you today. Thank you.
I'm so grateful. I wish you well with the podcast and all that you do. I think what you're doing is important work. So congratulations and well done. And thanks again.
Yeah, thank you for your time, Roger. I was fascinated. Could listen to more. That was brilliant. Thank you.
I hope you found that useful, everybody. Stay safe. Take care. Hope to see you next time on If I Knew Then, What I Know Now. Bye for now.